All right, we're starting here on the top of Pei Bed Amud Aleph by the Mishnah. Hatinokot ein me'anin otan b'yom ha'kippurim. We do not force them to have inu and yom kippur. Aval mechanchin otan lifnei shana lifnei shnataim. But we do start chinuch a year or two before. B'shvil shiyu regalim b'mitzvot. In order to prepare them to practice the mitzvot. The idea of chinuch is exactly that, that we try to bring them towards the final destination, which is that they will perform the mitzvah. So this is a preparatory stage to get them to do the mitzvah. How does that work? Hashto bifnei shtayim mechanchin lehu bifnei shana miboy. So Gemara asks, the Mishnah's layout is a little strange. It says, oh, we mechanich them a year or two before. Well, if you already mechanich them 2 years before, why do you have to do it a year before? So Amar Rav Chista, lokasho, habichuleh, habibari. Depends on the nature of the child, how healthy the child is. That will determine how early we start in terms of the process of chinuch, which is that if the child is a chuleh, then we only start a year before, whereas it's bari, we start 2 years before. But now we'll see what that layout is. Amar Rav Huna, ben chet u ben tet mechanchin oto lasha'ot. When it comes to 8 and 9, we are mechanech them l'sha'ot. We'll see in the Gemara later on that we have them fast a little longer than they normally do in a day. They eat breakfast at a certain time, we delay the breakfast. They eat lunch, we delay the lunch. We push out the hours on the day. So here we're speaking about someone who's 8 years old in one day, or someone who is 9 years old and one day. Ben Yud u Ben Yud Aleph, a 10-year-old and an 11-year-old, mashlimim midrabanan. They finish the fast, midrabanan, not an obligation midoraita. Uben yud bet, for everyone is mashlimi midoraita bitinoket. We're obviously speaking about a girl over here, because the threshold that we use as the final threshold is 12 years in one day, which is the year of a bat mitzvah for a girl.
A year or one day means her actual birthday.
Correct. Your birthday is a year plus a day later. So we have here 12 years old in one day. Everybody agrees that she is fasting midoraita because she's now a bat mitzvah. In the year before that, mashlimim midrabanan. They finished the fast midrabanan. In the year before that, it depends on whether they are healthy or sick. If they are healthy, then they're going to also finish the fast that year, the 10 years in one day. And if they are a chola, then they will only be mitaneh l'sha'ot. They will only do an hourly fast then. So for a healthy girl, starting at 8 years in one day, she already fast l'sha'ot. Then, subsequent year, a healthy girl, 8 years old and 9 years old, she will fast l'sha'ot. Then ben yud, or ben yud aleph, mashlimim, which means that 10 years old and 11 years old, she'll be mashlimi derabanan. And then 12 years old, she'll be de'oraito. On the other hand, if she's a weaker constitution, then only starting at 9 will she do l'sha'ot. And that would be true for 9 and 10. She will do it l'sha'ot. 11, she will be mashlim l'rabanan. And then 12, she will be mashlim mid'oraito. What's key to Rav Huna's position is that there is this buffer of called mashlimim mid'rabanan. We have chinuch l'sha'ot. We have one level where she does it hourly. Then we have another level where she finishes the whole fast mid'rabanan. And then we hit the final stage, which she finishes d'oraito. So those are the three different stages in Rav Huna's position. Now we have Rav Nachman. Nachman Amar, Ben Tet, Ben Yud, Mechanchin Otan L'Sha'ot. So Rav Huna started at 8 and 9. Here we have Rav Nachman starting at 9 and 10. So you already know there's a difference in their opinion. And he says, Mechanchin Otan L'Sha'ot. Ben Yud Al, Ben Yud Bet, Mashlimim Midrabanan. Ben Yud Gimel, Mashlimim Midoraita. And he does not argue on Rav Huna that we saw before because he's talking about a Tinok. So even though we just saw that he started a year later, the reason he's starting a year later is because the bar mitzvah is at 13 years old is a year later. And so therefore, Rav Huna and Rav Nachman are of the same position, which is there are three stages in the chinuch. There's chinuch sha'ot, mashlimim mid'rabanan, and mashlimim mid'oraita. Therefore, for Rav Nachman, a healthy boy will be mitaneh for sha'ot when he's 9 and 10. He'll be mashlim mid'rabanan when he's 11 and 12. And then at 13, he will fast mid'oraita. One who is of a weaker constitution will be mitaneh l'sha'ot for 10 and 11. And then at 12, he'll be mashlim mid'rabanan. And 13, he'll be mashlim mid'oraita. So that's the positions of Rav Huna and Rav Nachman who agreed. Their difference of opinion is solely due to the fact that one's talking about a girl and one's talking about a boy. They are explaining this idea of Rav Chista, like, lo kasha habichole habibari. Now we have Rabbi Yochanan, who disagrees completely and says, hashlamah d'rabanan leka. There is no completion of the fast midirabanan. That doesn't exist. The only thing that we focused on is michanchin l'sha'ot. So that means ben yud u ben yud aleph michanchin onto l'sha'ot. Ben yud bet mashlim mim midoraita. So this obviously is speaking about a girl. If she is of a stronger constitution, then she will start fasting l'sha'ot at 10 and 11. She'll do it both of those years. And then at 12, she'll fast deoraita. Whereas, if she's a weaker constitution, she'll fast the sha'ot at 11, and at 12, she'll finish the fast deoraita. So Rabbi Yochanan, there are only two stages. There are hours, and then deoraita. There is no buffer of finishing the fast, midrabanan, according to Rabbi Yochanan. That's the end of the machloket. Now the Gemara is going to challenge. Tznan. Hatinokot, ein ma'anin otan v'yom ha'kippurim, aval mechanchin otan lifnei shana v'lifnei shtayim. So that's our Mishnah, which says that the tinokot, you do not force them to do inoy, but mechanchin otan, we do give them chinuch lifnei shnana v'lifnei shtayim, 1 year back or 2 years back. Now bishlam al Rav Huna v'Rav Nachman, according to Rav Huna v'Rav Nachman, I can explain what's the difference between the year and the 2 years. How come they give two thresholds in terms of this? So they say lifnei shana v'lifnei shtayim. Why do you have both of them? Because lifnei shana l'divrehem, lifnei shtayim l'do'oraita. Okay, that's the girsa that we're going to follow. Makes it much easier to read, which is that it's a year before you have to finish midrabanan, which is 2 years before you have to finish de'oraita. So the 1 and 2 years are referencing the same point in time, which is a question of what your reference point is. If your reference point is finishing the fast midrabanan, it's 1 year before that. If your reference point is finishing the fast midoraita, it's 2 years before that. So that's how they explain the lifnei shana and lifnei shnatayim. But the Rabbi Yochanan, kasho. According to Rabbi Yochanan, there is only one reference point. The only reference point you have is the doraita time that you fast. There aren't two reference points. Time of the chah, Rabbi Yochanan, my shana o shnatayim, which is 1 or 2 years, samuch le pirkan. It's similar to the way that Rav Chista explained us the mission originally, which is, it means 1 or 2 years close to the time when they are going to fast. And that has to do with Bari and a Chole. So whether he's a Bari or Chole, they're still referencing the same point. The 1 and 2 years references the same point in time, which is 13 for a boy or 12 for a girl. Why is it 1 year or 2 years? That depends on the constitution of the child. That's not that there are two reference points here, and it's talking about the same year, but rather it's one reference point, it's talking about 2 different years. The way that Rav Huna and Rav Nachman solved the problem, they say there are 2 reference points. That's why the Mishnah gives 2 times, because there are 2 reference points, they're talking about the same year. On the other hand, Rav Yochanan says, no, there's 1 reference point, and the 2 different years are talking about 2 different individuals. It's talking about a Chole and a Bari, but the reference point is the same. So that's how Rav Yochanan will solve the problem. Tashma, the Tani Rabba Bar Shmuel, Tinokot, Ein Me'anin Otam B'Yom HaKippurim, Aval Mechanchin Otan Shana Oshtayim Samuch LePirkan. So now we have Tinokot, Ein Me'anin Otam, they don't fast fully, Aval, but what we do for them is Mechanchin Otan Shana Oshtayim Samuch LePirkan, a year or two close to there, being Chayavet, or Chayavot, Midoraita. Bishlama, the Rabbi Yochanan Necha. The way Rabbi Yochanan explained before, this works well, because he has chinuch, that's a 1 year or 2 years before samuch lepirkan. That's exactly his setup. Ela Rav Huna v'Rav Nachman kasha. Rav Huna v'Rav Nachman, they start, first of all, before that point in time. And number two is that they have a different reference. It's not samuch lepirkan. For them, it's samuch lepirkan, because they have that buffer year where they fast midirabanan. Samidacha rabbanon, my chinuch, nami diktani, hashlama. What's the chinuch that we're talking about here? That means they completing the fast midirabanan. Umi kari l'chinuch hashlama. Is that really what you call chinuch? Chinuch is finishing the fast? That's called chinuch? Batanya is a chinuch. Hayah ragil le'chol b'shtei shot, machilin oto l'shalosh. Normally eats 2 hours into the day, you wait till the 3rd hour. B'shalosh, if he usually eats 3 hours into the day, machilin oto b'arba. That's what mechanchin oto means, but that's fasting the shot, which means you're pushing back the shot. But that means the definition of chinuch is Sha'ot, and not finishing the fast. You're right. There's 2 different types of chinuch. There's chinuch l'sha'ot, and there's chinuch of hashlama. So they're going through stages of chinuch. So when they're talking about here and that braita they bring from the Tosefta, they're saying, oh yeah, when it says a year or two before the pirkan, that's talking about the chinuch of finishing it midirabanan. That other braita that you just brought here that says that the chinuch has to do with sha'ot, that's the chinuch before that chinuch. That's the original chinuch process, which starts a year or two before they do hashlama dirabanan. So that's how we'll solve the problem. In terms of the Psak Halacha, it's interesting here, the Rabbeinu Chanan notes, he says that Ugdechavatayu Kaimalon, we hold like them, Batrayinun, because they are later Amoraim. So they're already later Amoraim, so the Rabbeinu Chanan says we pass them like them. Kevan, Tahani Machmiri, Ve'inon Batray, Kaimalon Kavatayu, Utrei, Chinuchai Havu. And because of that, there are two levels of Chinuch. And that Hashlama, the Rabbanan exists. What the Rabbeinu Chananel says is, even though generally the principle that we follow is that Halacha ki Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan trumps almost everybody, trumps Rabbi, trumps Shmuel, trumps everybody else, so certainly he's going to trump Rav Nachman, who's a Talmud of Shmuel, or Rav Huna, Rav Chista, he's going to trump all of them. So why here are we saying Halacha is not like Rabbi Yochanan? So the Rabbeinu Chananel says because two things. One is their machmir, because they say more years of preparation. And number two is because they are Batra, that they are later Amoraim. Usually that shift for later Amoraim only happens after Rava. From Rava and onward, we say already Batra have power. They have powers because they have the ability to see all the opinions that came before them. So they have the ability to be Poseik or to be Machri Alacha is because they're looking at the full deck. They can see everybody there and then they can make a decision. Whereas the earlier Amoraim are only looking at a limited number of opinions, and therefore they can't make necessarily a decision. But you have to be late enough to be considered a batra. Meaning that you're not just a batra because you're later than the person before you. Batra means that you're already far enough along that you have a very good view of what's happened. But generally, it's assumed to be in the time of Rova and onward that we say that we pass them like a batra. Correct, that happens at certain periods of time where we have, for instance, why are there periods like the Shulchan Aruch? Who closes a period of the Rishonim, he's the one who's machriya in terms of what we do. Even though, you know, all the Rishonim that came before him, but because he has a whole picture, and he's bringing a closure to an era, we follow the Shulchan Aruch in that way. Today, it's harder to know, but the Mishnah Berurah did a similar thing in our modern era. So the Hungarian Jews, they kids the Shulchan Aruch, Poland, they used the Chayodom, but the Mishnah Berurah took hold probably a lot because, first of all, he has notation for everything, where everything comes from, and he uses Svara. You can see him being mefalpel and Svara about what the things are, even though many times it's Machriya L'chumra. Because of that, the Mishnah Berurah was a significant work, and probably about a closure to a certain time period before him. Now, everybody else who writes after him uses that as their reference book. So if I tell you you want to know Halacha, you go look in the Mishnah Berurah, and even someone argues, they're going to be, this is what the Mishnah Berurah says, and this is what, you know, I say. And that's because it becomes the book of reference. So same way over here, by Batra, it has to be a point in time where already there is enough information in front of you where you can bring a conclusion or a closure to a certain era. So the question of whether that applies here with Rav Nachum, Rav Huna, and Rav Chista, who are maybe not late enough to be Batra, but the Rabbeinu Chananel says they are Batra enough that we're going to pass an halacha like them because they are both Batra and they are the Chumra. Now we move on to the next Mishnah. Ubra Shericha. A woman who is pregnant that gets a whiff of something that engenders a very strong desire within her. So the Chazal believe, and the Rishonim echo this as well, that once the woman gets this desire for a certain item, they don't get in way of a pregnant woman. So here the Gemara assumes that it's also dangerous for the woman if she does not get that fulfilled. Dangerous for the fetus and dangerous for the woman if she doesn't get this satisfied. So therefore, machilin ota ad shetashiv nafsha. We give her whatever the item is until she comes back, until she feels like she's stable. Chole machilin ota al pi bikiyim. Someone who's sick, then we ask the experts, we ask the doctors, what should be the prescription for this individual? Vein ein sham bikiyin. If we don't have experts, we don't have doctors to answer the question. Machilin ota al pi atzmo ad shemar dai. We feed him based on his own assessment until he says, it's enough, I don't need any more. We'll get to this in the Gemara. This has major implications today in terms of who determines whether a person fasts on Yom Kippur or not, and how do we make those decisions. We'll get to that in tomorrow's daf. Today's daf, we're going to deal with the idea of sakanat defashnot pikuach nefesh. Tana banan. Uvra sheiricha basar kodesh ubasar chazir. A fetus that gets smell of basar kodesh or basar chazir, things that are otherwise asurim to eat. So the Gemara's assumption, again, is that's the fetus that's generating the feeling. It's not the woman herself. The fetus wants it, and that engenders the desire within the woman, but she has to satisfy the fetus, otherwise there's going to be danger to both parties. So tochlin lak ushperotev, but you take a needle, some sort of stake, some sort of pin, and you dip it in the rotif, you dip it into the sauce, and you put it by her lips to see imniyat yashva data, to see if that's enough to satisfy. I mean, that the desire just means that I get a little bit of it, and that's enough. If that's it, mutaf, then we're done. If not, machilin ota, rotif atzma. Then, if not, we feed her the gravy itself, the sauce itself. If that's enough, then fine. If not, we give her what the actual item is. So we try to move through the process in a manner that takes it from the least severe to the most severe. It's pikuach nefesh, because it's pikuach nefesh, the Gemara is going to say now, there is nothing that blocks pikuach nefesh, and the assessment here is that this is pikuach nefesh, therefore, we're going to take care of her. We're going to take care of it in a manner which says we're going to start from the least severe and move to the most severe. We're going to try to avoid at all costs her having to eat the dreifus over here, to eat the basar kodesh, the basar chazir. In the end, if that's what it takes, we're going to go there. But until that point, we're going to try everything possible not to give her that. Now, obviously, that's all in a position where delaying or tarrying is not going to cause any more of a problem. Delaying or tarrying is, then we don't worry about that. We do anything and everything possible to take care of the individual. We don't worry about severe or not severe. But if we have a window of time, then we're going to try the least severe to the most severe before we capitulate and give her the isur. Yeah, technically yes, but we don't believe today that it's going to cause a kanat tefashot. So their assessment today was that is pikuach nefesh, but if there is a reason that for a woman that would be pikuach nefesh in a pregnancy, yeah, the answer would be yes. But today we don't believe that the smell, her not getting to her ice cream or her pickles is going to be a kanat nefashot. Only for the people around her, not for her herself or the baby. But she herself will not be in sakana, so we don't allow for it. But again, if there's an assessment of sakana, there is no question. All right, so now the Gemara has the principle that we're following is, Ishein lecha davar shel mei bifnei pikuach nefesh, chutz mi'azvoda zara, gilui arayot u'shvichut damim. Aside from the three cardinal sins. The three cardinal sins are what we call yehareg ve'al yavor. One has to give up their life and not violate them. And so those three cardinal sins are offsetting the normal principle, which is that if there is sakanat tefashot bikuach nefesh, the Torah does not stand in the way. So now, avoda zara min alan. How do we know that a avodah zarah trumps one's life? How do we know that? Tetanya. Belozo omer, im ne'amar, if it says in Shema, avta et Hashem elokecha b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, u'b'chol me'odecha. So if it says b'chol nafshecha, lama ne'amar b'chol me'odecha? Im ne'amar b'chol me'odecha, lama ne'amar b'chol nafshecha? Why does it mean that you have to love Hashem with all your life and with all your possessions? Because if a person puts a priority or a higher value on his life than he does on his possessions, so if that's your highest value, then the Torah says your highest value is your life, that you have to utilize to love Hashem. For some people, possibility that their possessions are worth more than their life, their money is worth more than their life, then for that individual, the Torah says, then there's a requirement that with all your possessions that you love Hashem. So from that we say there is a priority given to loving Hashem. What is v'haftat Hashem lekecha? The demonstration that Hashem is the only God. And avodah zarah would be antithetical to that principle of avat Hashem. Since it's antithetical to avat Hashem, you are required, even b'chol nafshecha, even b'chol me'odecha, to give up one's life and their possessions in order not to violate the isur of avodah zarah or of the lack of avat Hashem. Right. So your point, which is brought up as one of the reasons why we're allowed to violate mitzvot in terms of pikuach nefesh, one of the reasons given is chalel alav shabbat achat. If you're mechalel one shabbat, kadesh shishmor shabbatot harbeh. If you mechala one Shabbat, then you preserve the ability to keep many more Shabbatot afterwards. So that's a general principle of the Torah, which is v'chai b'hem, that the Torah is not given for you to die by the mitzvot, it's given to you v'chai b'hem, to live by them. So anytime there is a clash between chai b'hem and doing an aveira, we're going to say chai b'hem trumps. Your life takes precedence. But, and that's the but here, there are certain cardinal sins, which makes it that it is no longer worthwhile to make that equation. That comes up with avodah zarah, because they are so fundamental. We're going to see why they're so fundamental. Because of that fundamentalness of these mitzvot, they do not allow you to make the decision to say, I'm going to override the mitzvah in order to preserve the ability to do mitzvah later. Because once you violated this mitzvah, then is it really worth it anymore? I mean, that if you're kofer bakol, if you no longer are worshiping God, you're worshiping avodah zarah, then you're already in a position where, what's afterwards? We always say there's room for tshuva and all these things, but if you're put in that position, the right decision is to give up your life for Hashem. The Torah does not give you a waiver in that situation. So now, the Gemara says, Gilui Arayot, Mishfichu Damim Minolan. How do you know that this does not only apply? Obviously, for Avodah Zarah, we understand. We have the Pasuk, and we can understand why it is. Gilui Arayot, Mishfichu Damim, what's the source for them? Again, I understand that they are severe mitzvot, so is Shabbat. We don't say this by Shabbat, we only say it by Arayot, Shvichut Damim, Titania. Rabbi Omer, Ki kasher yakum ish areyu uretzacho nefesh, kena davar hazeh. This is speaking about the Pashat Ki Teitzei with regards to a Naraha Miurasa. This is a girl who is engaged, engaged halachali, means she has kiddushin with a man, and now another man is coming to perform a arayot with her. The din is, if she is a willing participant, then they are both put to death. If it was done against her will, then obviously, the individual perpetrates the crime is put to death. The woman is paturkas onus rachmana patre. That in a case where she is unable to protect herself, she was forced into a position. So therefore, the Torah waives the need to punish her in that case because it was against her will. She had no control over the situation. In the pasuk, it says there, ve'ein moshia la. There is no one there to save her. So it happened out in the field, and this person rapes this woman. And she had no way to protect herself, and there's no one else who can intercede on her behalf in order to protect her. So now the Gemara learns from that, we're going to see in a second, that Ve'in Moshiala means that if someone could protect her, they would be obligated to intercede in the situation and protect this girl. V'chi, Ma'inyan Labanu Mirotzeach, L'Namara Amirusa. What do we learn from Motzeach to Nara Amirusa? Ella, Harizeh Ba'al L'Lameid, V'Nimtza L'Lameid. This came to teach and ends up learning. So the way the pasuk is structured is the Nara Merusa is similar to Rotzeach. Which means I've learned something from Rotzeach to Nara HaMerusa. The Gemara says here is not only does that happen, but it actually works in the reverse. Which is Rotzeach is going to learn something from Nara Merusa. Which is, Ma Nara Merusa Nitan Hatzila Binafsho. This is your question, Fred. Just like Nara Merusa, you're allowed to take the life of the individual who is perpetrating the crime. You're given permission to take his life because it says, Ve'ein Moshiala. That means if you are able to save this woman, no matter what the means are to save this woman, you are permitted to do it. Now, again, in this situation, you have to do the least severe to the most severe. If you can simply, by injuring him, stop him, that's enough. If that doesn't work, and the only way to stop him is to kill him, then you have permission to kill him in this case. You're granted permission to save this girl. So just like you're granted permission to save the girl in this case, so too, Afrotzeach. That Rotzeach has that same dispensation, which is, Nitan Latzilo B'Nafsho. If someone's running after another individual to kill them, then you're allowed to intercede and kill what we call the Rodef, the one who's chasing. You're allowed to protect the victim from the perpetrator of the crime. Now, the other way around, what did the Rotzeach come to teach you about Manara Merusa? Marotzeach Yehareg V'Al Yavor. Afnara Merusa Yehareg V'Al Yavor. So what's the principle that we learn? We learn from Rotzeach. Rotzeach is Yehareg V'Al Yavor. You're not allowed to kill in order to preserve your life. The Gemara is going to ask in a second, how do you know that? But now, given that that is true, it says, just like by Rotzeach, you're not allowed to kill in order to preserve your life, so too by Nara Merusa, which is, we'll call it the header for Arayot, you're not allowed to perform Arayot to protect your life. Now, Rotzeach Gufei Minolon. How do you know that a Rotzeach is not permitted to kill someone in order to protect their own life? It says, Suborahi. I don't need a pasuk for that. That is a simple and logical argument. Da'ahu da'ata l'kamei d'rabo. This individual came before Rabba. Amarle mare dorai. The governor of the city said, Katle leplanyo, kill this individual. Vilo, if you don't kill him, katlina lecho, I'm going to kill you. Take your choice. You either kill that individual or I'm going to kill you. Samale, nikat bach, velo tiktol. Says, you should die and not kill. Mai chazit de dama didach sumak tfei. How do you know that your blood is redder? Dilma dama dahu gavra sumak tfei. maybe the blood of the other individual is redder. So over here, when you take a life, you're weighing or making a decision as to which life is worth more. That you don't have a right to do. When it comes to Isurim in the Torah, I can say, I'm weighing between your life and violating Isurim. Over there, that's not a problem. I can say, my life is worth more than all of these Isurim, and that the Torah grants you permission to do, which is v'chai bahem. But when it comes down to weighing between your life and someone else's life, how do you have a scale that weighs? How do you know that your life is worth more than their life? Or the other way around. I know their life is worth more than your life. It can be used both ways, which is maybe you should kill because maybe your life is worth more. But what do we tell them to do in the end? Be passive and not active. If you kill actively, then you actually did an avera b'yadayim. If you step back and you're passive, then you make no active decision. You don't do anything wrong. And the life is lost, but you did nothing to cause that loss of life. So over there we say, better to be passive than to be active. That's the way the most Rishonim formulate it. Rashi here has an unbelievable formulation of this. And he says, what are you thinking? You're thinking the Torah says, v'chai bahem, v'lo shimot bahem. So, ta'amo shel davar lefish chaviv v'nafshan shel Yisrael lefnei ha'makom yoter min ha'mitzvot. Hashem basically says, your life is worth more than all of my mitzvot. That's exactly what God says. V'chai bahem says, your life is worth more than any other mitzvot that I put in the Torah. So now, that's my consideration here. Okay, my life is worth more than the aveira of killing. So why? I should better not do the aveira of killing than to give up my life. My life is worth more. Over here, the Torah says, v'achshav sheyesh kan Yisrael ne'arag v'mitzvah b'teilah. Then, uh-oh, wait a minute. Over here, if God says life is so precious, over here there's going to be a loss of life anyway. So when you say a loss of life is so precious that God says it overrides all my mitzvot, that's when there's preservation of life, and then there's a violation of a mitzvah. But over here, when your decision is going to involve the loss of life anyway, then maybe we don't make that judgment. Rashi has an interesting implication. And the implication from Rashi is, and it's a difficult implication because it's not necessarily true of the halacha, is that Rashi says here, the loss of life is what's important. Which would mean, according to Rashi, you could possibly conclude that if there was a choice between saving five people and saving one person, then maybe we would allow you to do something actively because the whole thing is preservation of life. So if I look at five people being saved versus one person being saved, do I say in that case, maybe it's better to be a rotzeach and save the other five people than it is to allow one's life to be taken and have all the five people die. Rashi's interpretation opens up that possibility that if it's all about preservation of life, then maybe we should have to weigh how many lives are at risk here. And because of that, maybe you come into those decisions. Halachically, we generally don't do that. We don't say how many lives are involved. We don't allow you to actively kill, even though it means that there's preservation of many lives. Unless, again, the person is mugdar kirodef. Unless they're a rodef, which means it becomes a defensive position rather than a offensive position where you're doing it to protect your own life. But Rashi's interpretation opens up that window to that possibility. The other Rishonim, who simply formulate it as the difference between active and passive, then there's never that window. You always remain passive in the face of murder because we don't allow you to take lives. Because how do you know what the weight of lives is? It doesn't matter if it's five or one. We don't know how to weigh or to understand the difference between lives. I'm going to come back and discuss this more in detail. I just want to finish up to the end of the daf, and then we'll come back and discuss this in more detail. There was this pregnant woman, a fetus that smelled something. They came before Rabbi. Amar luhu zilu luchushula. Go whisper in her ear. Diyoma kipurimhu. Then it's Yom Kippur. Luchushula vilchisha. So they whispered to her, and it placated the fetus. Bariale, he quoted the pasuk from Yirmiyahu. He's actually speaking about Yirmiyahu himself, which is b'terem etzarcha b'beten yedaticha. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Over there it's saying that I have designated you to be a Navi already from the time that you were conceived. But over here too, it's the idea that this Ubar, Yidaticha, he recognizes Hashem. He understands the mitzvot. And when you whisper to him as Yom Kippur, he backed off. Nafik Mina, who was this fetus? Rabbi Yochanan. Hi, Ubra D'Archo. We have another case where a fetus smelled something. Atu D'Kamei D'Rabbi Chanina. It came before Rabbi Chanina. Amarlo L'chushula. Whisper to it, it's Yom Kippur. Whisper it, there's something wrong. Below Yilchisha. It was not satisfied with that. Bariale, Zoru Rishayim Irochem. The Rishayim go astray from the womb. Nafak Mina. Who was this fetus? Who was born from this? Shabtai. Otsar Pere. Shabtai, the monopolizer of the market, the cornerer of the market. He used to go into the marketplace and buy out all the fruit in the marketplace and force the prices up. He was cornering the market and forcing the prices up in order to make money. He was monopolistically taking out all the supply in the market in order to raise the prices and cause problems. Now we have a Gemara Baba Batra, where long before modern era, where that became illegal, the Gemara already says that it's a sur to lafkiyat the sharim. It's a sur to corner the market in order to push the pricing up. And the Gemara had price stabilization with certain core items or necessities, where the Gemara says that you can't raise the prices beyond a certain point, and they protect within the core necessities of individuals that the prices had to be stable in those areas in order to prevent people from being basically starving to death and not being able to get their basic or bare necessities. Right, so we're going to stop here in terms of the Gemara. What I want to go back to, obviously there's this large Tosafot over here that deals with Yehareg v'al Yavor. Tosafot has a number of different stages. I'll go through each of the stages because there are other Rishonim who don't agree. The first stage that Tosafot points out is, when it comes to these violations or these mitzvot, he says, based on what I said before, how the Rishonim explain it, except for Rashi, that the requirement of Yehareg v'al Yavor is only when you're actively involved, not when you are passively involved. And he makes that distinction. First he says, let's talk about it at the level of murder. The level of murder, if the individual says, look, either you kill this individual, or we're going to tie you up and throw you on top of somebody, and they're going to die because you're going to throw you on top of them. In that case, you have no obligation to do anything or to desist, because the killing here is done passively. You are not actively killing anybody else. And the only issue, Tosafot says here, is active killing. Tosafot says this everywhere in Shas, where it says Yehareg v'al Yavor. He says that the only restrictions in Yehareg v'al Yavor is when you're actively involved. That means if you worship Avodah Zarah, when you are the one who does it. If they force you to bow down before the Avodah Zarah, that you don't have to give up your life for, because you're not worshiping the Avodah Zarah. They're going to push you over. They're going to force you over. If it's going to be, again, where there's going to be manslaughter, it's not going to be murder. If you're going to be thrown on somebody and you're going to end up killing them because you remain passive, over there you have no obligation to give up your life. All right, so then Tosafot extends that to Arayot. And there it has big implications. Tosafot says, just like in these other cases, only if you're active are you in violation, so too by Arayot, you're only in violation if you are active. That has major implications between men and women. Men who are active in the performance of Arayot have the cardinal sin of Yehareg v'al Yavor with the Gabe Arayot. Women who are passive in the situation of Arayot, they do not have an obligation to give up their life. The expression used in the Gemara in Sanhedrin is Karka Olam Hi. Right, very good. Arister Karka Olam Hi. That's what the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Ben Sorer Moreh says. That since they are passive, they do not have an obligation to give up their life in the face of Arayot. Now that happens to be a machloket over there. One answer given is that it's Karka Olam Hi. That's one answer that's given. But that answer is given about by Esther. Why is Esther permitted to? What was the problem by Esther? Esther has a secondary issue, which is Bifarhesia, which we are not going to discuss in our Gemara, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin deals with it. What happens if it's public? When it's public, all the rules change. In public, you might have to give up your life for any mitzvah. Forget about three cardinal sins. You might have to give up your life to demonstrate the importance of Torah. There, the Gemara talks about Gzeret HaShmad, Bifarhesia. Those might have different rules. Over there, it invokes the principle of Esther, Karka Olam Hi, that she is passive. So that would imply that Rava gives an alternative answer with regards to why Esther was Mutaret, the only dispensation for Bifarhesia. But if it was a question of Arayot, does he really think that Karka Olam works? Maybe not. Now, one of Tosafot's proofs is a Gemara here that we just glazed over, but the Girsa here is very important. It says, Af Nara Murasa Yehareg V'al Yavor. It's formulated in the male form, meaning that if a Nara Murasa, it really should say, Tehareg V'al Tavor. It should be formulated in the female form, if we're talking about the Nara HaMurasa herself, that she cannot be involved, and she has to give up her life. But that's not what it says. It says, Yehareg V'al Yavor. So because of that, Tosafot says, it's clearly talking about only the male participant, not the female participant. She does not have an obligation to give up her life. There were Rishonim, Girsos of Tehareg V'al Tavor, which obviously would have major implications in terms of whether a woman has an obligation to give her life, up her life, in certain cases of Arayot. Tosafot then works through positions in where a woman might be an active participant, where they tell her that she must bring a man onto her, she must do something active to create the position, that maybe in those cases you would have an obligation. And Tosafot deliberates, and other Rishonim deliberate, whether there is such a concept. by a woman to be active in the process of arayot, or by definition is she always passive in the action of arayot? The second question is by a man. Can you have a man be passive inside of arayot? It has to do with a Gemara in other places, which is Ein Kishui Ela Ledat, that a person can only reach an erection when they're actively focused on it. It doesn't happen by accident. Gemara assumes that a person has enough control over this that they could stop such a thing. So that Tosafot discusses what happens if a person knows they can't control it. Then does that become onus, or does he have to give up his life because he knows he can't control that situation? So Tosafot plays around with whether there can be such a concept within arayot of passiveness with regards to the individual. And that's the first thing that Tosafot discusses. In general, we do believe that it's only when you're active there's a problem, when you're passive you're not. And that would have a large dispensation for women inside of arayot if they are unseen, if they are being forced in these cases. The next thing that he deals with is, what happens if a person does not give up their life? What's the din in that case where they don't give up their life? Are you now in trouble? So Tosafot says that in the end, you're an ones. You were forced into the problem. And when they say to you, look, do this, otherwise we're going to kill you, you're under duress. You perform the Avera under duress, ones rachmana patre. Torah says you're patur in that case. So even though you're obligated to give up your life, if you make the mistake and you do go ahead and do the Avera, then we're going to say that it was under duress. You're not going to be held culpable for it. That's the general view of the Rishonim, although there are others like the Rambam and others that say that you actually violated the mitzvah, whether it's Harei Mitzchayev B'Nafsho. Now the Rambam agrees you're not going to be punished in Beit Din for this, because, okay, it's still done under duress, and that's where Yigirat Teiman comes up, about whether, even if the person violates it, what is the outcome of violating it? There he still tear himself inside of Yigirat Teiman, it's not so clear what his position is. In the Mishnah Torah, at least, he says that a person may not do this, and if he does it, then he's in violation, but we're not going to be punishing him in Beit Din because of the onus rachmana patre. But the Rambam really feels that you have then violated that mitzvah, and you're held accountable for that because you did the wrong thing. You made the wrong decision over there. So Tosafot over here is clear that you get a waiver, even though you're not supposed to do it. But the Rambam and others believe that even though you have the technical waiver of lachatz of ones, but the Torah gave you the prescription, that is, give you up your life. If you made the wrong choice, then you violated the Aveira in a place where you were not permitted to violate the Aveira. The Rambam also says that if one does voluntarily give up their life, where they have no obligation to do that, whether it isn't one of the three cardinal sins, harizeh mitchayev b'nafsho, that person has given up their life improperly, and they'll be held accountable for that. That is not the view of many of the Rishonim, as the Kesef Mishnah points out on the spot, that many of the Rishonim believe that it's optional. Yehareg v'yavor is mandatory. Yavor v'yehareg is an option that you may use that dispensation. But if you choose not to use that dispensation, you have permission to give up your life to uphold the tenets of the Torah. Right, the last thing he deals with is, if a woman is involved in one of these situations, so the Rabbeinu Tam suggests that in these cases of duress, you don't have a din of Heareg v'altavor, that the woman may not become asur to her husband because it's an akum that's perpetrating the crime. Since it's a non-Jew, his bia doesn't have the impact to make her asura bala. He says biat akum, it's biat behema. There you don't have a din of Heareg v'altavor. So the Rivam, his brother, says he doesn't think that's right. He says that biat akum is considered beit behema with regards to yichus. But as far as bia is concerned, it's still oseret abala, and he proves it from the Gemara in the beginning of Ketubot, that the women used to give up their lives when the hegmon, the governor of the city, used to say any woman who was getting married had to go sleep with the hegmon first. So over there, they were giving up their lives because of that. So the Gemara there says they wanted to stop that practice because it was wrong. They didn't have to give up their lives because karka olami. But it's clear that the bia of the akum was problematic. And so because of that, the Rivam says, I don't think he's right about that conclusion about the bia takum. It only refers to his yichus, but not to the fact that he can be oser her al ba'ala. All right, we'll stop over here.